Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 4th of June. With most of the votes counted in India's election, the Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi looks set to win a third term in office, but lose his majority. Qatar says it's waiting for a clear position from Israel on the Gaza peace plan. And one of Thailand's most wanted fugitives is extradited from Indonesia. Also in the podcast...
There was this one case where a published article started the introduction with the sentence was, "Sure, I can help you with that introduction." So it was something that was kind of obviously written by one of these chatbots.
The growing use of AI in scientific research papers. Ahead of India's six-week general election, the ruling BJP said it aimed to win 400 seats. That supermajority would have allowed Prime Minister Narendra Modi to change the constitution and reinforce his Hindu nationalist agenda, prompting an opposition figure to warn of a possible dictatorship. But with more than 90% of the 642 million votes counted, the BJP is falling short of that target. It is on course to lose its majority, winning about 240 seats, down from 303 last time. The party will still be able to govern with its allies, making Mr. Modi the first leader since Nehru to win a third straight term as Prime Minister. Syed Zafar Islam is the national spokesman for the BJP.
Whatever the result be, it is primarily because of the love and admiration of the people of this great country. They have voted for the Prime Minister. They had voted in the past. They are voting this time also to ensure that a good governance model continues in the country.
Sagarika Ghosh is a member of India's upper house of parliament and a leader of the opposition Trinamool Congress Party.
The opposition was being targeted by agencies, we were being targeted by institutions, we were targeted by money power, we were being targeted by media power. In spite of that, the Indian voter, the humble Indian voter, has rejected all this propaganda, rejected all this authoritarian personality cult of Mr. Narendra Modi. As far as I'm concerned, I think Mr. Modi has suffered a decisive personal defeat.
Turnout was 66%, slightly lower than last time, which analysts put down to the heatwave in parts of India that left dozens of polling staff dead. As counting continued, I spoke to our correspondent in Delhi, Divya Arya.
The BJP is well short of a simple majority, which would be 272, past 272 in a 543-seat parliament. So they're clearly going to depend on their allies to cross that 273 mark. But it seems that the biggest news is not just that Mr. Modi has got a drubbing, because the whole election campaign was literally run in his name and on his face. He was on billboards everywhere we traveled to, you know, towering over the local leaders who were contesting in those constituencies. In rally after rally, he repeated the campaign pitch, which was Modi's guarantee. So he kept saying that, "Vote for me." So all votes were not for the local candidates, but for the Prime Minister himself, because he was guaranteeing that he would deliver on all the promises that his government has made in the last decade. So clearly, it is a mandate that is speaking about his popularity and him as a guarantee figure. And the other part is, of course, the resurgence of federal politics, of regional parties, as well as the Congress Party, which had received a huge drubbing in 2019. Congress has almost doubled its tally, and by the time the counting closes, they may even better that.
Narendra Modi, a massive figure on the world stage. At home, he's been accused of cultivating a personality cult. Why does his attraction appear to be fading, at least at home?
Well, a lot of people criticize the divisive nature of his campaign. A lot of Muslims I met said that nothing is really left to doubt anymore. It is so unabashed. It's so out there. And it seems that it's okay to be anti-Muslim or to voice hate speech, because it is being done by leaders of the ruling party, including the Prime Minister, who called Muslims infiltrators in one speech. In another speech, he said, choose between vote jihad, which seemed to refer to a jihad by Muslims through their vote power, voting power, comparing it to the rule of Lord Ram. So do you want vote jihad or do you want the rule of Lord Ram? So those kind of speeches, which were flagged by the opposition to the Election Commission, were cited to us by ordinary Muslims, but even ordinary Hindus who felt that this kind of divisive campaign wasn't in good taste and wasn't good for democracy. That said, that may not be the only reason. We have witnessed highest levels of unemployment and inflation in the past few years in the run-up to these elections, and those may have had a huge role to play as well.
And briefly, might we see a different style of governing if these results turn out to be the final result?
We very well could, because this BJP will have to rely on its allies. It will have to build consensus. It has been accused of bulldozing various kinds of legislations, including laws that govern media, curtail speech, has changed the way the Election Commission, for example, is constituted, making it a body that has majoritarily got the ruling party's representatives. So those kind of legislations would be harder to push through. They will have to build consensus, including in the various policies they are now going to push for in the new term.
Divya Arya in Delhi. Two key regional allies of Narendra Modi's coalition have endorsed him as India's next prime minister, meaning he is likely to get that historic third term. But after the BJP lost its majority, should this be seen as a victory or a defeat for the strongman leader? Here's our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
He made it all because of him. It was all about himself in the campaign. So he was campaigning in all the seven phases. So he became the center of attention, the lead campaigner. So for his supporters, they will see this as a personal defeat for Mr. Narendra Modi. Because what it has done is, it pricked the bubble of his invincibility about his authority in the country, that he was a leader above everyone else in the country itself. Now, the results also mean that for those who are watching how the democratic path this India is taking, they want a strong opposition party in parliament. So this will also encourage other independent institutions, empower institutions like the Supreme Court and the media to take a more objective look and then see whether they can criticize the government's policies or they can take actions on some of the contentious issues. Now, there is a fear among when I speak to many of the bureaucrats and journalists, say, what will happen if I say against Mr. Modi? So this result has, in a way, diminished his authority and his aura, as you can explain, about Modi. And this can have a long-term implications.
Yeah, I mean, is this a watershed moment for India? If he had got that majority, he could have enshrined this Hindu nationalist agenda, changed the country for many, many years. But now we're seeing Congress, the opposition, recovering slightly. So are things looking very different?
There was a real fear that if the BJP had got a massive majority, you know, things could have gotten worse in terms of what the BJP called the Hindu supremacy, the ideas they kind of re-emphasizing among the public. And this was one of the first elections in my 30 years I've seen where the political parties in the opposition talking about save the constitution, save democracy, save the rights of people. You know, this has come back. People are holding the constitution book in their hand in campaign, like we need to save the constitution. This is quite remarkable, people coming back and expressing their authority and willingness to fight for the country. Now, the Congress coming back will give them more energy. Now they know that Modi can be defeated and Modi can be, you know, challenged in a people's court. So that will give them the advantage in the coming elections, and that will set a new course for the Congress party and its allies.
Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan. There are now thought to be fewer than 80 hostages left alive in Gaza after four more were confirmed dead by Israel on Monday.
We assess that the four of them were killed while together in the area of Khan Yunis during our operation there against Hamas. The information we confirmed by the relevant bodies after assessing new intelligence that we gathered over the last few weeks.
Israeli military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari. The chances of further hostage releases will depend on ceasefire talks, which are being coordinated by Qatar. Its foreign ministry says it's still waiting for a clear Israeli position on the proposal made public by President Biden on Friday. Hostage negotiator Mickey Bergman has suggested that if Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is not prepared to strike a deal with Hamas, then the US president could pursue his own agreement for those American citizens still being held. But how close might a deal be? Mickey Bergman has been talking to the BBC's Sarah Montague.
I wish I was optimistic on this, but I can tell you, Sarah, that after the first deal, it collapsed after it was successful for a while. There were about 10, 14 days of fighting in which negotiations didn't happen. I flew back to Doha at the request of members of the Israeli mission to explore what is available and what is possible for a next round. And I can tell you that as of mid-December, a deal very similar to the deal that we have now was on the table. But we entered a very frustrating part from there until now. This is about 6 months in which we had to try and convince Israelis and Hamas to come together and to agree at least to get into this first stage of this agreement. One of the reasons that we have these gaps or the inability to execute is because there's a real gap between what the Prime Minister of Israel is willing to commit to and what Hamas is demanding. Now, there's a complete mismatch between the Israelis and Hamas in understanding how negotiations work or how they should work. But right now, we saw President Biden last weekend basically outing the proposition that he believed Bibi Netanyahu has provided him over and over again. He made it public in order to pressure the Israeli Prime Minister to stick with it. But in the next few days, we're going to see whether the Prime Minister, if he wants the negotiations to succeed, he needs to publicly talk about what has been achieved and what is in common.
But he has again stated that his priority is the elimination of Hamas. He says we've gone the extra mile to bring them back, but the goals of the war primarily the elimination of Hamas.
Unfortunately, that's why I am not very optimistic that even this round will work, because the Prime Minister is focused publicly on highlighting the gaps and his unwillingness to commit that going into this agreement in good faith will be the end of the war. However, again, this is not exactly what he was telling quietly to the Americans. So the fact that the president made it public put Bibi a little bit in the box. And I think if Bibi indeed keeps sabotaging this with his statements, Biden is putting himself in a position where he has a moral authority to increase the pressure and potentially even engage in a humanitarian indirect track to at least help the American citizens who are still being held. And as you mentioned, there are 8 of them.
You said that in the situation with the Gaza hostages now, that President Biden should consider working independently for the U.S. hostages. Are you seriously suggesting that that's the next step?
Not exactly, but in principle, yes. I want to suggest the fact the U.S. President has a responsibility for his own citizens. Now, he has worked really hard for 8 months trying to get a deal for the totality of the hostages. And it has been it's succeeded at the beginning and has been failing since for the last 6 months over and over again. And I believe that pursuing a deal that will help get some of the Americans back home is not doing it in spite of Israel or despite Bibi Netanyahu. Not at all. It's a way to demonstrate that it's possible and be able to kind of open the door through this. So it's not a negative. And by the way, they're Americans. They're also Israelis. They're dual citizens. So I think there's an opportunity to do that. And I think the president has a responsibility to do whatever he can to bring back Americans home.
Mickey Bergman talking to Sarah Montague. The use of artificial intelligence in writing up scientific research has rocketed by 50% in the past year, according to a study of 15,000 academic papers. But what does it mean for the accuracy of the research? Richard Hamilton has been investigating.
About 18 months ago, the tech company OpenAI unleashed its chatbot, ChatGPT. Within a couple of months, 100 million users were regularly using this tool, making it the fastest-growing consumer app in history. This same phenomenon is being seen in scientific research papers. Dr. Frederick Howard, who's assistant professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, looked at the prevalence of artificial intelligence in cancer research. By using AI content detectors, he found that it had doubled in 2023. He says this new technology has clear advantages but comes with inherent dangers.
These tools can really speed up the writing process, and so that can be definitely a benefit, and it can help with maybe the wording of sentences, you know, when you're trying to draft something and you just can't get the right phrase. But these tools definitely have their limitations, too. In particular, it's been well shown that the text that's generated by these models can sometimes contain things that are completely fabricated. Kind of a very clear example is oftentimes if you ask to describe a scientific study, it will give a citation to a study that just doesn't exist. And, you know, it's very demonstrably fake. The problem is if researchers are using this tool and not adequately reviewing the output of these types of large language models, then you might end up with things that are being perpetuated in the literature that are just untrue.
Dr. Howard says AI is a very powerful tool, but it has to be used responsibly, and stresses the need for proper safeguards to root out factual inaccuracies in research papers.
There was this one case where a published article started the introduction with the sentence was, "Sure, I can help you with that introduction." So it was something that was kind of obviously written by one of these chatbots. Aside from cases like that, it's going to be pretty difficult to prove with 100% certainty that something was written with one of these tools. Maybe it will just require editors to make sure that they're doing due diligence and the peer reviewers are doing due diligence to ensure the factual accuracy of content.
Despite the rapid rise in the use of artificial intelligence, a survey last week of 12,000 people across 6 countries suggested most adults had only tried tools like ChatGPT once or twice, and there was less enthusiasm amongst older people. Yet even with this generational divide, artificial intelligence is here to stay, and it may be that we just need to control it better.
Richard Hamilton. Still to come on the Global News Podcast. Why nostalgic music events have become so popular. To Hungary now, and when voters go to the polls in the European elections in the coming days, Prime Minister Viktor Orbán will be hoping to increase his Fidesz party's share of the 21 Hungarian seats. But a former member of his inner circle, Péter Modzsor, has split away and formed his own party, and he's now enjoying soaring popularity. Nick Thorpe joined him on the campaign trail.
An early summer evening in Nyíregyháza. Péter Modzsor walks through the adoring crowds like a rock star, a dapper 43 years old. Then he swings himself up onto an improvised stage, a white pickup truck spray-painted with the Hungarian tricolour. As he does so, a favourite song of his, an anthem by the 80s Hungarian rock band East on the 1956 revolution, blasts from loudspeakers. He's a powerful speaker, the first charismatic leader the opposition have had for many a long year. He mercilessly mocks the current government, attacks the vast sums it spends on propaganda. His message is designed to appeal to left and right, to reunite a deeply polarised society.
We have to choose between lies and truth, corruption and clean public life, East and West, propaganda and real news, theft and honesty, and finally between Fidesz and the Tisza party.
After the rally, his fifth that day, he spends an hour and a half shaking hands with the crowd, listening to their concerns, taking selfies with them. Only then, close to 10 in the evening, does he have time to relax and eat. The next morning, over breakfast, in a quiet guest house just outside Nyíregy Háza, we talk.
Day by day, I'm realizing that I made a good decision to quit this system, and the situation is much worse than I imagined 2 or 3 months ago. The situation is much worse in the countryside. Poverty is everywhere. The disappointment of the people, the strong feelings, and I hope that we will have the chance to defeat Orbán and this government in a peaceful manner.
You've been very critical of Brussels and the European Union.
No, I'm not. We are a member of a club. I know Brussels from inside and outside. I know the European Parliament as well, all the institutions. We will be a normal and constructive member of the club, but if there is a necessity, we will be critical.
Peter Magyar's self-confidence is remarkable. He doesn't just want to sweep the Fidesz government from power, he wants to knock out the current, rather ineffective opposition as well. And unlike other opposition leaders, he's proudly national, almost nationalist. In fact, he sounds rather like Viktor Orbán in his younger years. It's a comparison he enjoys.
He was a democratic hero in the 80s, 89. He is the most talented politician in the political history in Hungary after the regime changed. But after that, his personality changed a lot. I think this is the starting point to be democratic, to lead in a democratic way a country, that your party is democratic and you are not a strong leader, but rather a smart leader, an inclusive leader.
His message seems to go down well. Bence and Lily, both 24, attended the rally in Újfehértó.
What I like most about him is that he's promising to end this awful division between people in Hungary. That's why we support him. And because he might be able to encourage some of the Hungarians who have left the country to come back.
That report from Hungary by Nick Thorpe. Today marks the 35th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing. It was on the 4th of June 1989 that Chinese soldiers opened fire at the mainly young demonstrators who'd been protesting for weeks in the hugely symbolic square right in front of the Great Hall of the People. It's estimated that hundreds, perhaps thousands, died. The communist authorities in China have long sought to wipe the event from history. But Taiwan's new president, William Lai, said today that the massacre would never be forgotten. In Hong Kong, the only place in China where public commemorations of the killings used to be held, security has been tightened. On Monday, police there detained an artist after he made a tribute to the demonstrators by writing the date in the air with his hand. Our China media analyst Carrie Allen told me that despite the clampdown, the anniversary would still be marked.
There'll be many people who will be marking the anniversary privately. And one of the ways that people do this in mainland China is by lighting candles. So there'll be people in their homes today who will be lighting a candle. You will also see this in places like Hong Kong and Taiwan as well. There are places today where people can gather for a candlelit ceremony. But in mainland China, there's very heavy censorship of this event every year, to the extent that even the candle emoji, the little picture that you get on your phone, is removed from social media platforms. So people can't post pictures of candles, cakes, for example, birthday cakes that have candles on them. These are just completely removed from social media platforms. So these very delicate ways of trying to commemorate the event, you won't see anything online. But I have to stress, people will be marking this today privately in their homes.
We mentioned Taiwan, the Taiwanese president speaking out. That's going to make him even less popular with the communist authorities in Beijing.
Indeed, yes. He said that we will continue to keep this historic memory alive. So that was a very strong message that he sent out today. And he did reiterate that Taiwan firmly stands by the belief that people only truly flourish with freedom and democracy, and very much reiterated the point that this event will be marked every year, even though areas like Hong Kong are increasingly starting to silence events that mark this anniversary.
And I guess the censors in China working overtime today.
Very much so, yes. But scenes in Hong Kong particularly interesting. A friend actually messaged me just before I came on air to say that she's near Victoria Park, an area where people regularly have gathered over the years to mark the anniversary. And she said the police presence is extremely high because there is increased wariness about people marking this event in public. People have been encouraged to do so in private, if at all.
Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen. Now to a mystery surrounding three newborn babies abandoned here in London over the past 7 years. The latest, a baby girl just 1 hour old, was found by a dog walker in a shopping bag on a freezing night in January. The BBC's Sancha Berg has been following the case in the family courts and gained permission to report part of the proceedings.
The new information is that baby Elsa, as she was called by medical staff because she was so cold when she was found, they named her after the character in Frozen. Baby Elsa, DNA tests show, is a full sibling of two other babies who were abandoned in East London in similar circumstances in 2017 and 2019. Now, the police made extensive appeals for their mother to come forward at the time. They had no leads. They have no leads currently in the case of baby Elsa either. And it is very unusual for one baby to be abandoned. Judge Carol Atkinson said it would be of enormous public interest to make public the fact that three babies have been abandoned by the same parents. All the babies are well, and the names that they were given at birth have now been changed. They're not known by those names. The two older babies have been adopted. And it does raise lots of questions because, as the judge said, it is very, very unusual for three babies to be abandoned by the same parents. Does make you ask what kind of circumstances is the mother in? And we argued that reporting this information could help find the mother and provide the help that she may need. The first baby was found in September 2017 in Plaistow, and the second baby in January 2019. The first was a little boy, the second a little girl. It's been a very long time. Releasing this information, and the judge supported this, could help find the parents because it is an exceptional case, more reminiscent of the 19th century than modern Britain.
Sancha Berg reporting. One of Thailand's most wanted fugitives has been extradited from Indonesia to face murder and drugs charges in his home country after escaping from custody last year. Chawalit Thong Duong was arrested by police on the Indonesian island of Bali last week. In return for his extradition, Indonesian police want help in capturing one of their own most wanted criminals, thought to be hiding in Thailand's forests. I heard more from our Asia-Pacific regional editor Celia Hatton.
Chawalit Thong Duong was arrested in Bali after a really high-profile escape from a Thai prison. He was actually in a hospital. He was supposed to be having a dental appointment. He was handcuffed to a bed and somehow managed to escape into mountains, escaped a shootout with Thai police, made his way to India, admitted to police later that he was worried he would be caught in India and wanted to make his way to Indonesia, where he thought he'd blend in a little bit better. He fled by speedboat to Indonesia. That's where he was caught by the Indonesian police. So he's now thought to be back on Thai soil. He was escorted amid tight security by Indonesian police back into Thailand today.
And they're taking him back, but that's not the end of the story because they want one of their own who they think is in Thailand.
That's right. So the Indonesian police are being very clear that because they are helping out Thailand, they want the Thai police to do more to track down somebody named Freddy Pratama, who they have wanted for 10 years now, who's thought to be hiding in the dense jungle near Myanmar in northern Thailand. Now, more than 800 people from Freddy Pratama's drug network have already been arrested. He's thought to be responsible for a huge drug network that extends from Thailand and Myanmar all the way down through Southeast Asia. And the Indonesian police are being very clear that they want more help in tracking down Freddy Pratama.
Yeah, and tell us more about the industry that he's involved in, this synthetic drugs trade.
Well, there's been an explosion, the United Nations says, in synthetic drug production and trafficking, mostly drugs that are being made, things like methamphetamine, ecstasy pills, that are being made in Myanmar, which is dealing with its own troubles, a civil war at the moment. And those things are being made in Myanmar and trafficked through Thailand and into the rest of Southeast Asia. UN officials tell me that they have never seen such a high level, a record amount of drugs being seized. And they're worried that that's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to synthetic drug production and trafficking.
Our Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. As the music festival season gets underway in Europe and the US, it's emerged that dozens of events featuring newer artists are having to be cancelled because of financial problems. By contrast, events with headline acts from the 80s, 90s and noughties seem to be doing as well as ever. But why? Music journalist Lisa Verrico spoke to James Kumarasamy.
We're living in an era of nostalgia in music. Everybody loves old music. We're not just talking about old people who originally listened to that music. We're at a crossroads with a time when festivals are struggling. So the latest news is that 45 UK festivals are cancelled or postponed this year, and people reckon it's going to be 70 by the summer. So something is happening at regular festivals, whereas the kind of retro festivals, which are aimed at older people with more disposable income, they're thriving.
And what about the other side of it? Some of the big acts saying, look, it's not really worth going to the festivals anymore. We have our big world tours and the festivals don't necessarily fit into it, whereas perhaps some of the older nostalgia bands are much happier to go along with the festival scene.
Definitely. So your big stars are touring much, much more. Big artists or brands want to have a lot of control over where they're seen, what they do, the staging. So they're not that keen on doing festivals.
It's not just festivals. I understand you went on an 80s cruise.
I did go on an 80s cruise. Well, the first 80s kind of event that I went to, and that was in 2002, Here and Now, Kim Wilde was on that, and I was a massive Kim Wilde fan when I was a kid. It's Culture Club, Rick Astley. And then in 2018, I went on a UK's first 80s cruise. I spoke to a lot of people on that cruise and they said, we used to go to gigs all the time, but we don't live in a big city now. We can't really afford to go and get childminders or whatever. And people say, I've seen more gigs in the last 2 days than I've seen in the last 25 years. This is the thing about the festivals. You get to see all these acts that you love, you can sing along to, they remind you of your youth. I would say that you used to say with artists, they would have their time and then they would go away, but they just stick around now. And there's not just the people that used to love them when they grew up with them, but young people love them as well now. So yeah, you're definitely onto a winner.
Yes, I guess Running Up That Hill became big when Stranger Things came out, and you have Sophie Ellis-Bextor's Murder on the Dance Floor recently as well. How much is it TV shows that have driven some of this nostalgia?
I think it's much more streaming. I mean, when Dreams by Fleetwood Mac took off on TikTok, Fleetwood Mac were already huge. You go to festivals and lots of cover bands playing Fleetwood Mac and DJs playing it at night. That's a thing that's been building for a long time. I think TikTok is more of the moment, but streaming definitely. I mean, you've got all music at your fingertips. And if you're listening to a song for the first time, it's new to you. So you might be hearing The Real Slim Shady for the first time. That's a new song to you. So I don't think that young people distinguish so much between old acts or old music and new music. It's just new to them. Sing the chorus and it goes. I'm Slim Shady, yes, I'm
the real Shady. Oh, you are the Slim Shady, so just dim my... Music journalist Lisa Verrico on the popularity of nostalgia music festivals. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by James Piper and produced by Alfie Habershon. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.